the church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century.
O come, O come, Emmanuel.
The 16th century.
Lord, keep us steadfast in your word. Help us to fight this evil.
The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
The world looks at me and thinks, you know, I'm a football player that's a Christian. And I look at the world and say, I'm a Christian that happens to play football.
Amen.
Speaking of naturalists now, they lean on rationality and understanding. But I think they're borrowing. Rational capital from the Christian worldview.
The abundant life that Jesus has for his Christians is not just a life of living, but it's a life of dying, all in his name, and all in the confidence that we belong to him.
And I think we should reclaim these terms, and rather than surrender them. We shouldn't surrender Catholic to the Roman Catholics, and we shouldn't surrender Evangelical to the Protestants.
Lord of truck drivers, love issues, etc.
Well, this is intriguing. I'm no archaeologist and I'm no ancient historian, so I read about the reported discovery of the bones of John the Baptist. Of course, what I picture first in my mind is some sort of full skeleton minus the head, something like that. Keeping with the biblical account, what it turns out to be are fragments of hand bones. And there are some ancient legends about a hand of John the Baptist being secreted away to Antioch. Well, these weren't discovered in Antioch, but in a church far flung from there. And some are saying, well, they might be at least a few of the fragments of the bones of John the Baptist. How would we even know? How could we even get close to determining whether they could be if we can't prove that they in fact are? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're coming to you live this Wednesday afternoon. It's the 20th of June from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio here in Collinsville, Illinois. Dr. Craig Evans joins us for the first few minutes. We're going to talk about this reported discovery of some of the bones of John the Baptist and get his evaluation, talk about how one would even go about tracing such a thing. Bill McKeever will join us after that. We'll talk about Mitt Romney's nomination, what it means to Mormons, what it means to people who share Mitt Romney's religious persuasion. 1-877-623-MYIE. That's our phone number. You can give us a call with a question or a comment. 1-877-623-6943. Send us an email. A question or comment is welcome there as well. We get them in real time here in the studio. Talk back at issuesetc.org or a tweet at issuesetc. Dr. Craig Evans is a regular guest. He's Distinguished Professor of New Testament at Acadia Divinity College in Canada and author of several books, including his latest, Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence. Dr. Evans, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd. Good to be back with you.
Even had these fragments of, I guess, knuckles, bones been found in Palestine, in and around the environs of Jerusalem, would there be any way of saying these are the bones of John the Baptist, even if we found them in situ, so to speak?
Well, yeah, I suppose, let me just be very theoretical for a moment and just say, well, you know what, if there was documentation and by that we actually had an ossuary with an inscription on it that said John, son of Zechariah, well, that would really, really improve the odds that these relics, that these bone fragments, the tooth and so on, actually belong to him. There has to be a chain of evidence. It isn't enough just to find some bone fragments and find out through DNA testing, guess what, it is a Middle Eastern man, perhaps a Jew, and guess what, it does come from the first century. That's all we actually know, Middle Eastern, first century, male. And so that leaves the door wide open for lots and lots of people. And so as I review this, and I know there are all kinds of legends about John and this, that, his hand and everything else, the evidence is so thin that it's hardly more than just the slightest possibility, and otherwise it's a lot of wishful thinking. There are, I think, far more important things we can talk about. Because, you know, like you were saying in your opening, if we had his whole skeleton, maybe minus the head or something, what would we learn from that? Well, we'd learn about how tall he might be or his size. We might learn some anthropological things. But we would really not learn anything that would expand on our knowledge that we possess thanks to what the Gospels tell us and what John what we're told about John and Josephus.
We know the manner of his death, that he is executed by beheading at the order of King Herod, that that the head is brought to one of King Herod's companions, so to speak, on a platter. We don't know what became of the head, but we do know that we're told that the disciples later came and took John's body and laid it in the tomb, and that's the end of the story. So the most you would expect to find there, if you were to find something, would be something like an ossuary. That you said documentation. Talk about how important it is for archaeology that you find things where they were left, and that you find things with, as you said, documentation or some kind of information attached to them.
Well, yeah, that's right. And sometimes what we find, we actually find a tomb that's been undisturbed. And so there are several ossuaries. We can find several skeletons. We actually find some inscriptions. We find some artifacts that help us date, help us situate the social location, you might say, of the people in the tomb, who they were, what kind of vocation they had, what status they had in society. We learn all kinds of things. Were they priests? Were they something else? Maybe somebody in the family was a scribe. And so we learn that kind of information, and that helps really narrow it down. And if we have several names, so-and-so son of somebody, brother of somebody, and we get that kind of information, there's then the possibility of actually identifying the family. We think we probably have the ossuary of Caiaphas, the high priest. We think that we have found the tomb of his father-in-law, Annas, and his family. So if there are two or three other people like that, we actually know who they are. And they overlap with either the history found in Josephus or with the Gospels and Acts. So there is some intersection between written history and some of the these archaeological discoveries. But that's the kind of thing we need. And when somebody's bones show up on an island in the Black Sea, and we don't have any certain chain of evidence, as it were, you know, to speak in legal terms, we're not really in a position to say that we really know the identification. All we know is that authentically somebody has some bones of a man, probably Jewish, a man who lived in the first century. That's all we have. That actually surprised researchers. They were expecting it to be a third, fourth century person, probably a European. Surprise, surprise, it really is Middle Eastern, maybe Jewish, and first century. But boy, that's not much to go on if we're trying to narrow it down to a particular person.
What was the surprise, and I don't know much about how such relics, I guess is kind of the theological term for them, are explored archaeologically, but was the surprise due to the fact that more often than not, these things do turn out to be well-meaning mistakes or well-meaning, even, I guess we could say today, imposters, hoaxes?
Yes, that's right. Many of them are, medieval Europe. That was a notorious feature. We had these peddlers, some of them were hucksters, traveling about from cathedral to cathedral, church to church, monastery to monastery. There was a lot of superstition. People attached huge significance to that, curative, healing powers, blessings, assistance, and prayer, and so on. So if you had a tooth or a finger bone or something like that, if you had a nail of the cross, that was especially treasured. If you had a piece of the cross. And so it was all kinds of stuff like that. And so the motivation for it, including greed, because there would be money paid for these things, there was a huge, huge motivation for these kinds of relics and pseudo-antiquities. And but, you know, when you have to remember, now, wait a minute, if this is the body of somebody, the Jewish people, and the early Christian movement was Jewish. John the Baptist was Jewish through and through, and they observed Jewish burial traditions. And you don't cart body parts around. That they may have done that at Christendom in the Middle Ages, but Jewish people don't do that. Yes, you have reburial of bones, ossuarium. Bones can be gathered up, placed in a satchel, and carried to another country. We actually have evidence of that. Jews who lived in Italy and elsewhere, they die. Their bones are then gathered up later after they've died and are transported back to the Holy Land. We actually have many examples of that. So it's theoretically possible, but the idea of somebody saying, oh, let's take his hand and cart that off out west to Greece or somewhere beyond, I mean, there's an element there that's un-Jewish and very, very unlikely. So I don't think the chain of command is very persuasive. The chain of evidence is very persuasive to me. What I think is more likely is a Christian pilgrim in the 3rd or 4th century, in the Byzantine period, might well have entered a crypt, and there are several there that are in Christian jurisdiction now in the Holy Land, and simply took home some bones that somebody either deceitfully or just naively said, I believe those bones belong to John, and just picked up some bones that turned out to be first century Jewish bones and then carted them off somewhere else, and they migrated westward until they ended up in where they are now in that island in the Black Sea. That's more likely what happened, and there was no real certain identification from the first century that really was John's bones.
Can you explain how it is that they are able to determine that this is someone of Middle Eastern persuasion and someone, in terms of dating, who would have died in and around the first century?
Well, all you need in the case of bone fragments, if you've got complete bones, then you have the interior of the bone, you have DNA material in the soft red center of some of these bones, and you actually can get a string of DNA. The mitochondrial DNA is all you need to determine, and that's the mother's contribution to the individual, and then you can determine racial features, and so that's how they were able to determine that it's Middle Eastern and probably Jewish. And with the accelerator mass spectrometry, AMS, the more sophisticated up-to-date carbon-14, you don't need much of a sample, and you can then date it. Anything that once lived has carbon in it. Once it stops living, there is a known rate of half-life breakdown as the carbon slowly reduces, and so that can be tested, and then we know what it should have, and if it, say, this person died yesterday, and so that's how we measure how long have they been dead as of this moment. That's how the dating is done.
When we come back, we'll talk about the limits of that dating method, some kind just called popularly carbon-14. Dr. Craig Evans is our guest. We're talking about the reported discovery of the bones of John the Baptist.
Over summer, 2.5 months of what a child learned in school can leak away. Call Sylvan to turn summer learning loss into a gain. Sylvan pinpoints exactly what skills your child needs in just 3 hours a week over 12 weeks. You'll see results in your child's math or reading performance improving one grade level guaranteed. Demonstrated through the pre and post assessment. So call now. At participating locations only. Some restrictions may apply. Call for complete guarantee details.
Get 36 hours for $36. Sylvan Learning Center of Shiloh, 618-628-0018.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start. The foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes. Dedicated customer service and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House. Listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House. cph.org.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Does your church need a full-time or backup organist? The virtual organist service from Church Music Solutions is genuine organ leadership using your instrument with your specific selections when you need it. You can try it out for free with our demo unit, which allows you and your members to hear and see the virtual organist without obligation and without a sales pitch. For more details, go to churchmusicsolutions.com.
Hi, this is Jonathan Cullen from France.
Thanks to God's gift of the internet, people are listening to Issues Etc. around the world.
First, I would like to say thank you very much for your program. Very much ministers to those of us who are outside the comforts and the luxuries of having a confessional Lutheran congregation nearby. Thank you very much for this great resource.
Listen to what you want, when you want, wherever you are. IssuesETC.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Craig Evans is our guest. We're talking about the reported discovery of some of the bones of John the Baptist. You were speaking before the break about, it's usually just kind of referred to as carbon-14 dating. What are the limits of that kind of dating? Does it have an age limit that it can not date past? And how accurate is it? Like, what's the window of accuracy on something like that?
Well, typically, carbon-14 is a plus or minus 40 or 50 years. So in a sense, it doesn't really help us nail it down. John the Baptist, we assume, was a slightly older contemporary of Jesus. And, so he's born somewhere in this window from 10 B.C. to 6 B.C., something like that. And he dies presumably in the year 28, something like that. We're not real sure of that kind of thing. And so there's no way carbon-14, for example, if we actually found John's hand and tested it, it's not going to say, oh, this person died in the year 28 A.D. It just doesn't do that kind of thing. And so even if we had an authentic piece of, John's skeleton, it's only going to say something like, this person ceased living somewhere between 10 or 20 B.C. and 40 or 50 A.D. Well, that doesn't narrow it down too much. And so carbon-14 confirms that we're in the right century or so. It tends to do that, and that's very helpful. It was great for the Dead Sea Scrolls because there was disputes. You know, this was very new to us when the scrolls were found. Do they really date back to 100 B.C., or are they medieval? You know, nobody really knew yet, and so carbon-14 settled that one. But in this particular case, where we're trying to identify a relic with a specific individual, carbon-14 doesn't help us much. All it's done is say, this is somebody that likely lived in the first century. Well, that's about as close as carbon-14 is going to take us.
And with regard to the DNA evidence, it's somewhat of, I would say, Middle Eastern Semitic bloodlines. But that includes a lot of people, and it's not just the Jewish people, right?
That's correct. It could be Idumeans, it could be Nabataeans, it could be Arabs. So it leaves the door wide open. It's consistent. If we had John's skeleton and tested it, we would come up with the same general findings. It would be a first century person of Middle Eastern origin. That would be very handy. Ultimately, Todd, the problem is that we don't have anything to compare it against. We don't have a known DNA sample of John the Baptist. And so, this isn't like police work where, we know, well, here's the blood type of the victim or here's the blood type and DNA of the accused, and then we can match it up with the blood splatter we actually find at the scene of the crime. We're not in that position. So we don't have two dots to connect. All we have is a dot. And so, it's consistent with what we would expect if it really did belong to John, but that's as far as we can go.
So the better way of locating and dating in archaeology really has to do with the context in which something is found and any other information that can be attached to it.
Absolutely. You're quite correct. And that's why archaeologists, are so dread, interference where people loot a site, carry things off, damage things. And then we find what could be a very important piece, and we find it in an antiquity shop or in the private possession, the possession of a private person. And then there's uncertainty about, well, where did it come from? The James ossuary that has been such a fuss in the news of late, even recently confirmed its authenticity, we still don't know where the ossuary actually was found. So even though the inscription now apparently is indeed authentic, where it says James, son of Joseph, brother Jesus, now that's just an amazing inscription. But the sad thing is, we don't know where it was found. If we knew where it was found, if it had been found unmolested, untampered with, all of the evidence intact, including skeletal material, who knows what we might have learned? Maybe it would have been determined that it really was the ossuary of Jesus' brother James, who led the church for about 20 years prior to his martyrdom in 62. So that's the kind of stuff you can learn, but it has to be found in context where there is a hope that we can find supportive, what I call documentation, inscriptions, other artifacts that point in a certain direction, help us with the dating, help us with the identification.
And even if someone were, in that case, to say, well, I got it from this guy, and he got it from that guy, and he sold it to me, and he says it was found here, that's still not proof that it was found there, that you're still just dealing with claims, aren't you?
That's right. You know, it's still hearsay. We're not sure. And some of these people are very shifty, especially because if it has been looted, they don't want to. There is no desire to preserve the chain of evidence because people might get prosecuted. And that's controversial. You know, some say that the antiquities laws inadvertently encourage looting and being very secretive about it. If instead there was a reward, look, you find something, that's great, just don't tamper with anything, you'll be rewarded. But there is no reward for finding anything, and so the temptation then is to simply steal stuff and sneak away with it and then sell it privately. Well, then the chain of evidence is lost, the context is lost, and a whole lot of what we could learn from the archaeological investigation just disappears. And that's a real tragedy.
So give us the short list of some of the best archaeological finds that reliable, that confirm New Testament events. And if you would, how liberal Bible scholars often deal with that kind of archaeological evidence. What are the best, your short list of things?
Yeah, well, in New Testament, I think the Caiaphas ossuary is right up there at the top of the list. You have the Pilate stone. So here's Pontius Pilate identified as a prefect. There was one time in radical skepticism, you know, the Gospels are distrusted, why even Pilate's a fiction? Well, all of that has been blown away. I think of great import is the crucified man with a Roman spike in his heel. His name was Jehohanan. So here's a man who was crucified and properly buried, which supports what the Gospels say about Jesus. Though he was crucified, his body was taken down from the cross and was properly buried. Because, you know, you're not going to find, your skeleton isn't going to show up in an ossuary a year later with your name on it if you weren't taken down from the cross and properly buried. So I would have to rank those as among the very top for the New Testament. For Old Testament, I'd have to give top prize to the inscription found at Tel Dan in northern Israel 20 years ago. The inscription refers to the house of David. This is a Syrian inscription from the 8th century BC. It confirms the reality not only of a King David, but that he actually had a dynasty and a boundary that reached as far north as northern Galilee. So that would have to be one of the top discoveries relating to the Old Testament. I would also add, I suppose, some of the ongoing excavation in Jerusalem itself, which probably has discovered David's palace and his complex of administrative buildings, which would argue for a government way beyond the needs of a relatively small city of Jerusalem, but would be government buildings for a larger empire stretching to the north to Dan, to the south to the Negev, and all the way west to the Mediterranean Sea. So these are some of the very important finds, and it's been really hard for some of the minimalists and the skeptics who have said, none of that existed. We keep making these finds, and they have to backtrack and say, well, maybe there was a David, maybe there was an empire. I guess I would, Todd, add one more. The Caiapha ostracon discovered just a few years ago. This was found at Caiapha. It's an ostracon. That's a piece of pottery. It has several lines of Hebrew writing on it, and it dates all the way back to the 10th century B.C. That's the actual time of King David and his son Solomon. And so here is Hebrew writing that shows that there was a skill necessary to write the accounts that we have in Samuel and Kings, and it reaches all the way back to the 10th century when these events were actually occurring. So I think these would be among some of the greatest finds of both the Old and the New Testaments, and they have been very difficult for the skeptics to deal with.
Real quickly, it's only about 30 seconds. I don't even know if archaeologists, students of archaeology do this, lest they be misled by their own desires, but what's your dream find, if something could be found?
Yeah, what's my dream find? I guess it would have to be something relating to Jesus. Maybe it would be a find relating to one of his disciples. You know, I guess an inscription, but for me, a manuscript find would be the greatest thing. To find a significant portion of a gospel or one of Paul's writings that actually dates to the first century. I guess that would be, for me, the dream find.
Dr. Craig Evans is Distinguished Professor of New Testament at Acadia Divinity College in Canada, author of several books, including his latest, Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Evans, it's good to talk with you again. Thanks for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd. Good to be with you.
When we come back, well, it's a foregone conclusion, of course. This summer's political conventions are not going to change anything. It will be, well, I guess, barring any unforeseen circumstances, it will be Governor Mitt Romney, it will be President Barack Obama facing off in the presidential race. And it will be decided in November. But, of course, this is historic in more than in one sense. It's historic if only in this sense that one of those men, Governor Romney, is, while Mormons in government are quite easy to find, he's the first one who actually has run at the top of a major party ticket. What does that mean if you're a Mormon? You watch these commercials. I'm so-and-so. I do this. I do that. I go there. I go here. I'm a Mormon. They are among us. They're here. What does it mean if you're a Mormon to have a fellow Mormon actually with a realistic crack at being president of the United States? When we come back, we're going to talk with Bill McKeever. He's out there in Mormon country about what Mitt Romney's nomination means to Mormons. You can join us with questions or comments, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Or you can send us a tweet at IssuesETC.
Would you like for us to post information about your congregation on the Find a Church page of our website? We'll add your church when it becomes part of the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to donate $1,000 to Issues Etc. Please consider adding the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. to your church's mission or advertising budget. Find out more about the Issues Etc. 300 at issuesetc.org. Click support and publicize your congregation to the world.
Steadfast Lutherans, people who believe the law condemns everyone and should be preached to the fullest. People who believe the gospel is for everyone and should be preached to its sweetest. Traditional Lutheran doctrine and practice deliver every Sunday this law and gospel, that Christ was crucified for us sinners. To all who received him, who believed in his name, the Gospel of John says, he gave the right to become children of God. To see how Steadfast Lutherans preserves this good news for everyone, visit steadfastlutherans.org.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Redeemer Lutheran, Mandeville, Louisiana. Our Savior Lutheran, Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin. Christ Lutheran, Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Emmanuel Lutheran, Louisville, Nebraska. Grace Lutheran, Warminster, Pennsylvania. Trinity Lutheran, Valonia, Indiana. Emmanuel Lutheran, Pensacola, Florida. St. Athanasius Lutheran, Vienna, Virginia. And Emmaus Lutheran, St. Louis, Missouri. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print the one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Will Republicans maintain their pro-life platform?
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
That Mitt Romney will be the Republican nomination for president now seems clear. Pro-lifers are keen to know how firmly Romney will defend the sanctity of human life. After almost 4 years of the most pro-abortion administration in American history, pro-lifers are hoping for a president who respects their conscience. Women deserve a candidate who supports real choice, not just abortion. And the unborn deserve protection. So far, Mitt Romney has pledged to defund Planned Parenthood, restore the life-saving Mexico City policy, appoint only constitutional judges to the Supreme Court, and select a pro-life vice president.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.